Indie Media is DIY news. It is about people reporting their own news directly without the need for reporters, bypassing the corporate media.
There are 100 Indie Media or IMC websites worldwide providing grassroots reports of struggles, campaigns and protests.
There are so many people here who are saying no to the government today, and this is democracy in action.
Everybody's here. Everybody in the country seems to be here. They're just coming from all over the place. The banners are showing all the tiny, tiny little pockets of the country. Everybody has come down here.
The project started 3 years ago covering the massive Seattle protests which shut down the World Trade Organization summit.
Uncensored and unsponsored, IMC sites can be updated anywhere, anytime, by anyone.
The open to all nature of these sites means that you can publish your own reports about your own issues and at the same time connect to a global network of grassroots news.
What you're about to hear are some of the highlights.
What you are about to hear are some highlights from these global websites and from our very own UK IMC Wire. For more information or to get the news direct from the streets, check out www.indiemedia.org.uk.
The world is waking outside my window. Bella ciao, bella ciao, bella ciao, ciao, ciao. Directs my senses into the sunlight. For there are things that I must do. Wish me luck now. I have to leave you. Bella ciao, bella ciao, bella ciao, ciao, ciao. With my friends now up to the city. We're gonna shake the gates of hell.
Hello, welcome to the show. It's the 4th of March and you are listening to Indie Media Radio London on Resonance FM 104.4. Today we have lots of stories from the Indie Media UK Newswire and Global Wires also, compiled as ever by our intrepid compiler, Planet Mail. We also have Eva, just back from Iraq, and Justin Alexander from Voices in the Wilderness. But now some Newswire stories. It's Fair Trade Fortnight, if you didn't know, running from the 1st of March to the 14th. The theme of this year's fortnight is A Taste for Life, celebrating the quality of life fair trade means for the producers as well as the quality of fair trade foods. It's also the 10th birthday of the fair trade market itself. And the Fair Trade Foundation announced this week that sales of products carrying the Fair Trade mark are running at an annual rate of £100 million. Fair Trade, backed by a vibrant social movement of people throughout the country, is now bedding into the mainstream, giving thousands of producers in developing countries the chance to build a better future and to compete in the all-too-cutthroat global markets, says Harriet Lamb, Executive Director of the Fair Trade Foundation. The rapidly rising sales prove that consumers do care and are prepared to pay the true price for products they know they can trust, guaranteed by the Fair Trade mark. Sales of products with the Fair Trade mark for 2003 totaled an estimated retail value of over £92 million, 46% up on 2002, when £63 million was spent by UK shoppers. By the end of 2003, shoppers were spending over £2 million per week at the checkout on products with the Fair Trade mark, compared with £2.7 million in the whole of 1994. Shoppers can now choose from over 250 products from over 100 companies, and more than 300 catering suppliers nationwide offer fair trade products. 10 years ago, there were just three companies offering products with the fair trade mark: Clipper, Fairtrade Tea, Green and Black Mayer's Yummy Gold Chocolate, and Cafe Direct Coffee. Fairtrade now has 18% of the UK roast and ground coffee market, and the British public eat a third of a million Fairtrade bananas every day. Some 6,000 events are expected to take place around the UK during Fairtrade Fortnight. There will be widespread activity around supermarkets, with supporters doing taste tests of Fairtrade foods and also around high street coffee chains. As a special focus of the 10th year of the Fair Trade mark, the Fair Trade Foundation has aimed to persuade the out-of-home sector to switch to fair trade. The Office of Government Commerce has just issued guidelines on how government procurement offices can source fair trade foods. Other institutions are also launching new buying policies to coincide with the launch of Fair Trade Fortnight. The Salvation Army, the UK's largest care provider after the government, is starting a switch to fair trade foods also. A move to be rolled out in its 800 centres and supported by TV chef Brian Turner of the BBC TV's Ready Steady Cook. The Youth Hostel Association, YHA, is also celebrating Fair Trade Fortnight by beginning the switch to Fair Trade tea and coffee in more than 200 youth hostels across England and Wales, as is the British Medical Association. For Fair Trade Fortnight, a host of towns are also gearing up to gain Fair Trade status. Five pairs of cities such as Oxford, Cambridge and Lancaster and York will put aside ancient rivalries to make a joint declaration of Fair Trade status, linked by a webcam at 1pm on Friday the 5th of March, and Cardiff and Edinburgh will also declare themselves as Fair Trade capitals. Universities including Edinburgh, Nottingham, Swansea and London School of Economics will declare Fair Trade status, joining Oxford, Brookes and Birmingham, which are already Fair Trade universities. So for more information, check out fairtrade.org.uk. Phew.
Meanwhile, the campaign to boycott soft drink Coca-Cola is gathering pace in universities in Ireland. The students at Trinity College have just voted to boycott Coke within their own campus, with approximately 1,800 voting to boycott it against a measly 1,600. Recently, at University College Dublin, a referendum to reintroduce Coke to the campus was defeated by a margin of 600 votes, increased from 57. Turnout was up, with over 4,000 students voting and 56% voting against the reintroduction of Coke. Coke had taken a number of steps to try and win this time, including sending their communications director in from Latin America last week and giving them free cans of Coke, taking students out to dinner and sending their workers in on both Tuesday and Wednesday. The boycotts are in support of the Sinatrainal trade union workers in Colombia, where workers and union leaders have been sacked, threatened and even killed for their denunciation of labour and human rights violations.
And with the ongoing controversy over the Labour government's plan to introduce top-up fees for university tuition rumbling away in the background, lecturers represented by the Association of University Teachers, AUT, went on strike recently over pay reductions, working conditions, proposed changes to union representation of lecturers and differential treatment of staff based on where they work rather than the jobs that they perform. The Cambridge AUT has called upon students to campaign with them for better pay and have pledged their support for student campaigns against variable top-up fees. Meanwhile, at Essex University in Colchester, students occupied the boardroom of university boss Ivor Crewe, a high-profile advocate of fees, and called for a protest movement that can force a shift in society's priorities away from warfare and greed and towards satisfying human welfare and need. Occupations have also occurred at Oxford University and in Sheffield, where the town hall was taken over by students. Direct actions against threatened closures of the chemistry, philosophy, development studies, sociology and anthropology departments at Swansea University are planned for the 10th of March. Top-up fees and the university system in the UK are usually discussed as if Britain was a lone island of turmoil in a wider ocean of calm worldwide. Within the mainstream press, there has been little recognition that a systematic, consistent set of structural reforms is being implemented around the globe by proponents of what might be called a neoliberal, marketized approach to education. In fact, there have been recent direct actions and protests by students all over the world, including Argentina, Australia, Canada, Germany, Pakistan and Russia. And now we're going for a track, and this track is Tarikwelli, which is Tarikwelli CD, and ready to go.
Good morning, Brooklyn.
No, no.
Another stop on the train. Stop that everybody gotta make. Whether you local or express. What's the meaning of ghetto fabulous? Not riding the back of the bus, I'm a revolutionary antagonist. Some players is mad at us for just doing our music out of love. Some underground heads is hating cause we have fun in clubs. I'm probably on some government list for my rhyme, and you a fool if you don't think that they already tapped your mind. Medicine is big business, so my remedies is herbal. It's music for the people, so we reflection eternal. Listen, you hear the difference between science and science.
science fiction. We blow it out like if you leave on every appliance in the kitchen at once. Still rolling con bud and Cuban blunts. On the corner watching how kids come into Brooklyn for their fronts. Niggas run past what they need, chasing after what they want. Fucking chumps, you walk down the street and get jumped. Brooklyn cats like to bubble out of town, no looking back. When you a ghetto chef, you master the art of cooking crack. Some get caught sleeping on the mother city, so when they go, they come back as tales of niggas we used to know. Never looked up to see the stars and all the heavenly glory. Just straight ahead, cause the peripheral is builders with mad stories. Not floors, but dramas is played out. Shorties get laid out like respect and fade out like TV sets into the banks of our memory.
Let it be.
We'll never forget you. Lying on your deathbed, asking for God to bless you.
Good morning, good afternoon, good night. What have you done with your life? Everybody time come to be embraced by the light. You're only scared to die when you ain't living right, man. And putting up a hell of a fight.
Pay your way to the ways that'll work.
I need you all to be clear on exactly what I'm saying. With your attention to span to understand that I ain't playing. You mistaken if you somehow think it's just me you facing. Staring me down while your enemy is standing adjacent. My heart is racing, but I know just what I stand for. We chasing death carelessly like Jessica. I care more who said it. Just because no one can understand how you speak don't necessarily mean that what you be saying is deep. In case you die in your sleep, you ask the Lord for a blessing. Sometimes it sneak up so quiet that the silence is deafening. You never know who the assassin is until it's your time to go. Your life is flashing, asking for forgiveness, but you move too slow. Now the people that you love bear the pain that you was harbored. You was living for yourself, so you could never be a martyr. Life is hard, death is harder. You somebody baby father, someone's lover, son of your mother, somebody brother, somebody nigga. Now your spirit in the air like a whisper. Hearing your name mentioned when we pouring out some liquor. The days go by quicker and the nights don't seem to differ. It's getting cold, so I shiver and ask my soul to be delivered.
Good morning, good afternoon, good night. What have you done with your life? Everybody time come to be embraced by the light. You're only scared to die when you ain't living right, man. And putting up a hell of a fight.
Lay your way to the ways of the world. To the ways of the world.
Yo, the time come for everybody. It ain't something you can really prepare for. Yo, yo, Matt Duke. Rock, rock on, and Curtis Mayfield, rock, rock on, and Grover Washington, rock, rock on, and my Aunt Hazel, rock, rock on, and Big L, rock, rock on, and Freaky Ty, rock, rock on, and Javody Green, rock, rock on, and Slang Tongue, rock, rock on, and we said.
Now, here with us in the studio today, we have Justin Alexander from Voices in the Wilderness, and just returned from an 11-month sojourn in the Middle East, where she worked in both Palestine and Iraq. We are pleased to welcome Eva, how do I say your second name?
Yashevich.
Yashevich, who is currently on a UK speaking tour discussing her eyewitness accounts of what she saw in Iraq. Many of you will have read her reports online, and obviously we cannot discuss Iraq today without mentioning the devastating bombing of the Ashura festival yesterday. And so coming back from Iraq, how is it?
Chaotic, decrepit, people still very stressed out, still very poor, living conditions haven't really improved. There hasn't been much reconstruction at all. There's just been a construction of a lot of military bases and prisons, maybe the odd school or the odd kind of cosmetic centre, like maybe a youth centre or something, but really very little reconstruction's been done, especially in terms of infrastructure. You know, water's still undrinkable in Basra from the tap. You still got to buy water from, you know, sellers in the street and whatnot, and there's blackouts all the time still all over Iraq. Electricity industry still hasn't been brought up to scratch. The north oil industry is devastated. The only export that's taking place is out of the south because the resistance attacks have been so effective in shutting down Kirkuk's oil fields. So yeah, it's chaotic, you know. 13 years of genocidal sanctions have devastated the country. Now the occupation is just perpetuating that, really.
Justin, you've also recently returned from Iraq. Whereabouts were you in Iraq and when were you there?
I was just in Baghdad in October last year, and I saw a lot of dreadful things there. But Eva has been further afield, and really a lot of people who go to Iraq just go to Baghdad, and you really need to see the south to really see that the depth of the effect of sanctions, which, as Eva said, is still continuing, and the structural problems, the devastated water system, the massive unemployment, the presence of depleted uranium in the whole of the environment, these issues just haven't been addressed. And so while the focus on the media in the media is on, you know, the bombings which are dreadful and the kind of the big political issues, what's being forgotten is what life is like for Iraqis just on the ground, and really that hasn't got. In fact, most Iraqis you talk to, while they'll say they're glad Saddam is gone, they'll say their lives, if anything, are more difficult, more chaotic, and with a lower standard of living than they had previously. So, but you know, against that, what you see is an amazing kind of warmth and hospitality, and Evra and myself both, you know, receive such a warm welcome from, you know, so many Iraqis who didn't judge us as representatives of Britain, but as individual human beings, and that's really, we got to see Iraqis as fellow human beings and not as any kind of stereotype.
Okay, and Eva, what do you think that people here can do to offer some kind of support for people in Iraq? And is there anything that we can do here without actually obviously visiting Iraq?
Yeah, there's a lot that can be done. There are people out in Iraq on the ground now. There's Occupation Watch, there's Voices in the Wilderness, there's the Christian Peacemaker Teams, there are foreign NGOs, there are also domestic NGOs. However, quite a few of them are fake, I've got to say.
In what way are they fake?
Well, you know, people are trying to make a buck, people are trying to, you know, just scam. There's a lot of scammers, there's a lot of corruption. It is very hard to find out who is telling the truth, and in fact it's mostly the people who don't know how to organize, haven't got a clue what an NGO is or even how to use a diary. Like, a friend of mine is starting up a women's group in Basra, and you know, she didn't know how to write a proposal. She, you know, people don't know how, you know, it's the Baathists that know how to organize. They're the ones who had the capital to set up their own organizations. They're the ones who know, you know, have the confidence, the capital, the connections. So you, if you want to kind of support grassroots initiatives, grassroots organizations in Iraq, which is what myself and other people at Voices were really trying to do, it's very difficult because the people that really need support are the ones that, you know, don't speak great English, are living in abject poverty, and you probably won't come into contact with them. You know, it's not the people who live in central Baghdad who've got, like, flashy business cards and stuff, I've found. So what can you do? Oh, loads of stuff. Do you want me to continue?
Yeah, it would be nice. I mean, last night at your talk, you mentioned about various women's centres. I wonder if you could tell us a bit about those women's centres.
Yeah, the Organisation of Women's Freedom in Iraq, which is an organisation that got set up straight after the fall of the regime, headed by Yanar Mohammed, who's already had two death threats and is looking at a possible fatwa against her because Awfi have a very militant stance on women's freedoms. They call for total equality between men and women. They also support women who are escaping honor killing, prostitutes who want to get out of the business. They're providing safe houses for women. They're doing really vital work that no other organization is doing, and they're seen as very, very radical. There's even some women's groups that kind of find them a bit too radical, and they're doing great work and they need support. You can check out what they've been up to on www.equalityiniraq.com. Then there's also a women's organization that's just starting up in the south in Basra. My friend Sarab is doing that with an American organization called Millennium. They're helping them. And she and a group of women from Hayaniya, which is the poorest area in Basra, they are looking to set up a microfinancing project for widows and divorcees, of which there are many, because, I mean, three wars really did wrench the heart out of the sort of young male population. You know, many, many people were killed, so there's a lot of divorcees and widows, and they need to support themselves. There's 70% unemployment overall, generally, in Iraq, so there's a hell of a lot of poverty, and this project is looking to help women form their own small businesses, make food to sell on the market, make clothing, you know, buy women's sewing machines, whatever kind of instruments or materials they need to get themselves on their feet, you know, and try and break this culture of aid dependency and people just addicted to handouts.
Okay, and I think Voices, and you're also from Jubilee Iraq, aren't you, Justin? They're quite concerned about the kind of national debt that has built up throughout sanctions and during this recent conflict. What's Voices kind of campaigning for in that area?
There are lots of kind of structural issues that we can campaign on here and really advocate for kind of the rights of Iraqis. And this one issue, which is very, very significant, is the foreign debt. During the 1980s, during the Iran-Iraq War, many countries financed Saddam with vast sums, and that now totals about $200 billion, including the war reparations awarded after the invasion of Kuwait. That's about 10 times Iraq's gross national product. It's the largest debt in the world by a large margin. And there's no reason why Iraq should, you know, repay any of that money. The Iraqi people didn't benefit from it. In fact, it financed the war, which caused them so much suffering. But currently the British government and the American government and many other governments, while they're prepared to reduce the debt by some amount, they want to keep a large amount on the books as a way of controlling Iraq. And this is a lever which is going to be used to privatize Iraq's economy, to force through the kind of neoliberal economic policies which have been promoted around the world via debt, across Africa and South America and Asia. This is what the Jubilee 2000 campaign was about. It failed, unfortunately. There has been some debt reduction, but very little, and that which has happened has been dependent on countries following the International Monetary Fund's economic policies. Now, we've got to stop this happening in Iraq. We've got to give the Iraqi people a future without debt and a future without control by the IMF, which essentially means control by the US. So this is an issue which has been ignored to a large extent, but is one of the key issues for Iraq's future. And it's something that we can do something about. So you can write to your MP, you can tell them to lobby Gordon Brown, you can check out the website jubileeiraq.org, and keep up to date on what the news is happening on this issue and be active.
Okay, and Eva, you're on a speaking tour at the moment. We're going to wind up this interview soon. Where are you going next for people that want to hear more about Eva's experiences in Iraq?
Oh, God. I don't know. There's a lot of stuff. Well, I'm going to be talking at the Dog Star in Brixton, Cold Harbour Lane, on the 9th. That's a Tuesday, I think. That's at 7:30. That's No Sweat, anti-sweatshop labour campaign based in the UK, looking at sweatshop labour in the UK and abroad. They've organised that. That's about workers' struggle and the new workers' movement in Iraq. And before that, I'll be talking at Goldsmiths College from 4 till 6. And I'll be in Brighton at the Cowdy Club, which is a great little social centre set up by good people from Brighton.
Hopefully,
I don't know,
you
look
can
on
post
the Voices
your dates,
website.
Yeah, post your dates to the Indie Media website as well, so people, if they want to hear what you have to say, can enjoy it.
Yeah, just a quick URL. If you go to my website, justinalexander.net/Iraq, there's a portal of links to the many campaigns and Iraqi organisations, and particularly web bloggers, Iraqis who are writing internet diaries, people like Salam Pax and Riverbend. Please do read those. And if you have any, if you want to give money to Iraqi organisations, then you can contact me through that and Eva, and we can advise you about really good organisations who are doing good work and aren't corrupt. Mm-hmm. And really, like a few £1,000 can make such a massive difference.
And that web address is?
It's justinalexander.net/Iraq.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
We about to set we tell you that
everything is everything.
Everything is everything.
Everything is everything.
Everything.
After winter, must come spring.
Everything is everything.
Yo, 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 yo. Our philosophy possibly speak tongues. Drums, Abyssinian, street Baptist, Baptist and fine linen. From the beginning, my practice extending across the atlas. I begat this, flipping in together on the dirty mattress. You can't match this, rapper slash actress. More powerful than two Cleopatras. Bomb graffiti on the tomb of Nefertiti. MCs ain't ready to take it to the Serengeti. My rhymes is heavy, like the mind of Sister Betty. El Boogie spars with stars and constellations. Then came down for a little conversation. Adjacent to the king, fear no human being. Roll with cherubims to Nassau Coliseum. Now hear this mixture with hip hop meets scripture. Develop a negative into a positive picture.
Now everything is everything. What is meant to be,
what is meant to be, will be. Sometimes it seems,
sometimes it seems,
we'll touch that dream,
we'll touch that
but
dream,
but things come slow and not at all,
they come slow, yeah.
And the ones on top,
the ones on top,
won't make me stop, so convinced this day might fall, let's love ourselves and we can't fail, to make a better situation.
Dance on Sainsbury's roof. Across the country last Saturday in seven different Sainsbury's supermarkets, disgruntled shoppers and bandit labellers took to the aisles to protest against the company's ongoing use of GM to feed the cows that produce their dairy products. Local grassroots group linked by GEN, the Genetic Engineering Network, organised the event, and more protests are promised across the country in the next few weeks. In Exeter, Sherborne, Taunton, Coventry, Bracknell, Wales, Plymouth and London, shoppers were leafleted and GM-fed dairy products labelled. The idea is simple: to stop the growing of GM crops by ensuring that there is no market for the GM fodder maize the government are trying to commercialise. In Holland, the supermarkets made a commitment to not use GM feed, and although they have GM maize with full approval, no one's planted any. Sainsbury's are seen as the first domino in the chain that needs pushing, because the big boys like Tesco won't go until they do, and they're financially vulnerable at the moment, as well as being linked to everyone's favourite pro-GM science minister, Lord Sainsbury. In Exeter, Alphington Road, Sainsbury's, two dancing cows occupied the roof with a banner declaring GM-fed dairy, untested, unlabelled and in here, and they stayed there for over 2 hours. Meanwhile, a banner lifted on two giant helium balloons hung from the ceiling inside the store. The tannoy was briefly taken over by protesters warning shoppers of Sainsbury's policy. A cow and a giant mutant maize handed out leaflets inside before being forcibly ejected, and three of the checkout girls spent their break outside with the protesters, asked for leaflets, and quietly said, "Good on you, we agree." The police were called, but were most embarrassingly cooperative, and there were no arrests, despite the entire milk and dairy stock being labelled by 17 other protesters, which resulted in the deputy manager running out, screaming to the police, "They've done criminal damage to our cheese!" Almost all the labelled products were subsequently removed by the staff, which will have amounted to a not insubstantial loss to Sainsbury's. There was a strong media interest, with almost all local TV, newspapers and radio covering the story. In Plymouth, people leafleted for an hour and a half, both inside and outside the shop, before the police were called, and GM-fed products were also labelled inside the store. GM, by the supermarket's own admission, is currently fed to the cows that produce their dairy products, as well as to the cattle and pigs that make their beef and pork in their non-specialist ranges. Yet there is no labelling to alert shoppers to the presence of this GM in the food chain. The Co-op and Marks and Spencers already sell totally non-GM reared meat and dairy as standard, due to deep customer concerns about the issue. And Iceland, yes. They have good reason to be worried. Bob Orskoff, OBE, director of the International Feed Resource Unit in Aberdeen, has said that, as a scientist, I wouldn't drink milk from cows fed GM maize with the present state of knowledge. Sainsbury's claim that they haven't kept their promises around being GM-free and labelling because of their, quote, concern about the commercial impact of this on farmers, yet the appallingly low price that Sainsbury's currently pays farmers for their milk is causing a crisis in agriculture. While they and other major supermarkets cream off huge profits on the massive markup on the shelves. John Sherrill, the chairman of Farm, the independent voice of farmers, explained, "Sainsbury's suppliers now pay farmers less than their production cost for their milk. GM maize will not end this injustice, but contaminate neighbouring farms and food crops, destroying more livelihoods." The protesters in Exeter were supported by Sainsbury's customers, who attached flags with the message, "Support farmers, not GM," to their trolleys, and who went to the customer services desk to demand that Sainsbury's start paying a fair price for GM-free milk. One of the campaigners added, "Safe food is a right, not a privilege, and at the moment people don't even know what's going into the food chain." A lot of the customers we've talked to are shocked that this backdoor into GM exists, and they aren't being told about it. After all the evidence about the environmental and agricultural damage caused by GM crops, and with the shadow of BSE hanging over us, isn't it about time Sainsbury's kept its promises? A spokesman for Sainsbury's said, "The integrity of the food we sell is our first priority, so we are surprised they have chosen to target us. We were the first of the major supermarkets to eliminate GM ingredients from all our own label products." More on GM and biotechnology now.
Bayer Crop Science, a favourite focus for many an anti-GM activist, is making redundant the bosses of all its GM programmes throughout Europe. In a move bound to be seen as an acknowledgement that it sees little future for the technology in this part of the world, among those made redundant is Dr. Paul Rylott, Bayer's UK head of bioscience, who has become the public face of the GM industry in Britain. The news comes just as the government is about to approve the planting of GM maize produced by the company in Britain, marking Dr. Rylott's greatest triumph. He will leave within the next month and is yet to find new employment. A spokesman in the UK confirmed that all heads of bioscience in European countries are to go. Last October, Monsanto, the world's largest GMC company, announced that it was closing its European cereal headquarters in Cambridgeshire with a loss of 80 jobs and pulling out of its cereal and seed business in the continent. The decision was hailed as a victory by environmentalists and was seen as the company throwing in the towel in the face of entrenched public hostility to the technology. Ministers privately believe that Bayer's move demonstrates a similar lack of confidence in the prospects for growing GM crops. Cabinet committee minutes reveal that Margaret Beckett, the Environment Secretary, told her fellow ministers that the government expected little market demand for its maize and therefore little cultivation in the short term. Bayer formally insists... sorry, I've lost my place now. Bayer formally insists that it believes that there is little that there is still a very, very good market in the UK, and insists that redundancies do not reflect its view of the prospects for GM crops, echoing similar denials from Monsanto last autumn. Yet Julian Little, a spokesman for the company, admitted that maize was never going to make a lot of money. He said that he expected that just a tenth of Britain's 250,000 acres of maize would become GM, and environmentalists dismissed this as a great overestimate.
Plain gold ring on his finger he wore. It was where everyone could see he belonged to someone, but not me. On his hand was a plain gold band. Plain gold ring had a story to tell. It was one that I knew too well. In my heart, it will never be sprayed. Long as you
Blackwood Tree Camp in South Wales, resistance continues against a road to link together two business parks. The 10-year battle against the road saw over 4,500 written objections from locals. Work started a couple of months ago, and locals and other campaigners have resorted to direct action to try and save their trees. The tree camp is in court today, and campaigners expect the court to clear the way for an eviction. The word is that a team of 36 chainsaws will be deployed soon, while rumours say that the team of bailiffs at Blackwood are earmarked to later move on to evict the much larger Nine Ladies protest camp. At Blackwood, Costain and subcontractors have been felling trees which are clearly marked as having bat roosts and dormice habitats, also clearly marked and fenced off. This is happening daily, but the police have strong evidence for at least two other occasions, and Costain sent the bat officer, who has to be there whenever there is any felling of potential bat trees, home for a week. Nevertheless, the Welsh Assembly is refusing to revoke the licence to work in the area where the habitats are, and by the time the police and CPS can press charges, damaging bat habitats and killing dormice is a criminal offence, it will be too late. Tree defenders have regularly been stopping work and making small blockades on the old railway track, which is part of the road route and passes the two tree camps. The contractors have to keep removing them to enable access. But not to be outdone, on St David's Day, contractors themselves erected their own concrete blockade to block vehicle access to the tree camps. At Sherwood Tree Defence Camp on Wednesday the 25th of February, Rob, a young lad in his early 20s, lost his footing on a walkway almost 50 feet up when he slipped on an icy platform, plummeting to the ground without any breaks in the fall. He suffered multiple injuries. 1 week later, Rob seems to be doing pretty well after the nasty fall at Sherwood Forest protest camp, and the extent of his injuries is not quite as bad as first feared. He has chipped the funny bone off of his left elbow and dislocated the elbow as well, which now has a staple through it. Ugh. His left wrist is also broken. What was previously reported as organ damage is now thankfully just a bruised kidney. He also has quite a bit of bruising, including two black eyes, and is reported to be in pretty good spirits. This was undoubtedly helped by the great response from people all over the world who have sent messages of support via Indie Media, including emails from Baghdad, Africa and America. So, get well, Rob.
Meanwhile, in London, the last area of land being squatted at Osry Road against Asda Walmart is expecting an eviction very soon. Osry Road is off the old Kent Road, South London. Campaigners who have already been through six different evictions have now barricaded all around the remaining land. There is a heavy presence of security employed by Walmart in the area, with many guard dogs in the buildings previously occupied by the campaigners. In short, the remaining campaigners have been in a state of siege for the last few weeks. For more information on this one, see www.osryroad.org.uk. Finally, the occupied social centre at Fortis Road in North London is still there.
Hooray!
And continues its programme of events, from workshops to film nights. They intend to stay in occupation until the end of this month.
it is a national security threat that is unique because there is no enemy to point your gun at. There is no enemy to point your guns at, and we have no control over the threat, says Doug Randall of the Global Business Network. But he's not talking about international terrorism. While last week Home Secretary Blunkett was announcing plans to take more of our freedoms away in order to protect our freedoms, and President Bush started his re-election campaign by banging on about national security, a report issued by a Pentagon think tank argued that it is climate change that should be elevated beyond a scientific debate to a US national security concern. The report, An Abrupt Climate Change Scenario and Its Implications for United States National Security, imagines the worst-case scenario. By 2020, climate change has unleashed nuclear showdowns over who controls what is left of the planet's water, with mega droughts, famine, and widespread rioting across the world. Major European cities sink beneath rising seas, and Britain is plunged into a Siberian climate. 400 million people become environmental refugees, forced to flee from uninhabitable regions. So just what sort of pinko hippie tree hugger is behind this report? Well, none other than the Office of Net Assessment, a secretive US think tank dedicated to weighing up risks to national security and headed by 83-year-old Andrew Marshall, nicknamed Yoda. This is the man who has held considerable sway over US military thinking for the past three decades and is best mates with Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld and champions the Star Wars missile defense strategy. The author of the report to Peter Schwartz, a CIA consultant and former head of planning at Royal Dutch Shell Group, and Doug Randall of the California-based Global Business Network, say that it might possibly be too late to prevent a disaster. The consequences for some nations of the climate change are unbelievable. It seems obvious that cutting the use of fossil fuels would be worthwhile, but with his pockets stuffed full of dollars from the oil and energy corporations, Bush is refusing to listen, instead ignoring or trying to bury evidence of climate change. His administration has kept the report on ice for the past 4 months. Last summer, in a 450-page report that covered just about every other conceivable threat to the environment, the Environmental Protection Agency chose to say nothing about climate change after the White House made major edits to the climate change section. With a 20th of the world's population, the US produces a quarter of the world's greenhouse gas emissions. Emissions are up 14% from 1990 levels and are projected to rise by a further 12% over the next decade. To understand the implications, the Pentagon asked scientists to look into what might happen if the conveyor current, which keeps the UK climate warmer than it should be, begins to falter. And what they came up with is the nightmare scenario already described. And while some might want to dismiss the report as fantastical rubbish, maybe they should chat to the people of Tuvalu, whose island is already slowly disappearing under rising sea levels. As Sir John Horton, part of the Intergovernment Panel on Climate Change, pointed out, the impacts of global warming are such that I have no hesitation in describing it as a weapon of mass destruction. Whatever new laws Bush and his ilk come up with, this is the new Cold War they should really be worrying about.
Moving on from that, almost 3 years after the G8 protests in Genoa, the truth is finally starting to emerge from the authorities regarding the torture and beating of demonstrators who were held at the Bolsonaro Detention Centre. On the 21st of January 2004, the daily Genovese newspaper, Il Secolo, gave an account of a police officer and a non-commissioned officer at the police penitentiary who had told the attorney, Francesco Lala, of generalised violence and abuse carried out against detained demonstrators. These declarations implicate the higher echelons, who at the time would have been informed of the facts, such as the police general and senior magistrate Alfonso Sabella. With this fresh evidence, a crack in the wall of the conspiracy of silence has been opened. The new testimonies of the police officers match the accounts given by scores of protesters who were detained at Bolsonaro. In the meantime, the charges against the 93 protesters badly beaten and arrested during the bloody police raid at the Diaz school have been completely dropped. On the 3rd of February 2004, the magistrate closed the entire procedure. Trials should be coming soon for the 73 policemen, mostly high-ranking ones, who have been recognised as guilty by prosecuting attorney for violence of, during the Genoa G8 summit's days, including senior officers accused of planting petrol bombs within the school. Yesterday, however, the trials against 26 demonstrators began in Italy. Supporters have converged upon Genoa for the mass trial of the activists, many of whom were arrested and coordinated in a coordinated series of 45 home raids across Italy on December 4, 2002, several of whom have been held in pre-trial detention and house arrest ever since. More than 50 activists were arrested after the summit was over for alleged activity during the G8. And Italian social centres affiliated with the independent media have come under repeated attacks since the summit. The activists are charged with devastation and looting, a vague term that carries a penalty of 8 to 15 years in prison. In addition to the criminal charges, the activists also face a civil complaint filed by the Ministry of the Interior, the Ministry of Defence and the Ministry of Justice. Another 50 to 60 activists are expected to be charged once the current court cases are out of the way. These include many who were stopped by the police and Carabinieri when they were trying to leave the city after the summit demonstrations, including members of the Public Theatre Caravan, an acclaimed theatre group from Austria, many of whom were badly beaten and tortured after their arrest. For more information on all of these issues, check out italy.indymedia.org.
And coming up next Monday is International Women's Day, with hundreds of events planned throughout the world and in the UK. In London on Saturday the 6th, women will be putting the government on trial for crimes at home and abroad. That's happening at Trafalgar Square between 3pm and 6pm and is sponsored by the Iraqi Women's League and the All African Women's Group. The event is part of Global Women's Strike, a global movement against war and occupation in Iraq, Palestine, Chechnya, Colombia, Congo and Kashmir. Women, who are the first carers and the first fighters for the survival of loved ones, demand that $1 trillion now spent on military budgets be used instead for basic survival needs. Clean, accessible water, food security, healthcare, housing, education, safety from rape and other violence, and the protection of our planet. Also on Saturday, a group will be performing Welcome to Fortress Europe Street Theatre, 9:30am at City Hall, London Bridge, and again at 1pm outside the Queen Elizabeth II Conference Centre in Westminster. There's lots of other events going on in London. For more details, check out www.globalwomenstrike.net.
Preparations are well underway for the Global Day of Anti-War Demonstrations on the first anniversary of the US bombing and invasion of Iraq, March the 20th. The Stop the War Coalition are holding a national demonstration in London with a whole series of events leading up to it. Elsewhere, the day before, on the 19th, protests and actions against the arms companies are expected across the country, while a demonstration at Menwith Hill Spy Base in Yorkshire aims to, quote, block the bases. For more information, see www.stopwar.org.uk and www.blockthebase.org.uk.
The Human Rights Watch International Film Festival is happening from the 17th of March until the 25th in London. The film festival has become a leading venue for distinguished fiction and documentary and animated films and videos with a distinctive human rights theme. Through the eyes of committed and courageous filmmakers, the festival showcases the heroic stories of activists and survivors from all over the world. That's happening at the Ritzy. And if you want to get in touch with us about the show, you can email irlnewswire@ziplip.com. And we look forward to hearing your comments. Well, we're just about out of time now. We're going to go out with a long Space Monkeys track. And we'll hopefully come listen to us next week. Bye-bye.
Bye. 1, 2, 3, 4. Hi, this is Lennox Lewis, undisputed heavyweight champion of the world. Just like Quali and High Tech Scene, run things rude boy. Big up.
Yeah, check it out now. Cry digger, yo. 30 ounces. Five big. Exhibit.
Come on. Check it.
1, 2, 3, 4.
Mommy, bitch, stomp the bogey outside.
Sound, sound, M-Y-A-Y.
We don't sound people.